Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
When I laid my eyes on him for the first time, I immediately knew that he was the one for me. He's amazing.
She's not talking about her husband. She's talking about her pug. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind
be
of be redone.
For
I first
tests.
Opened a little box
before
and there was a cell.
All of the surgeries selection have not prior
yet.
We're
just getting some of the medicine to you, right?
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
Our relationship with animals is, as we say on Facebook, complicated. That's an understatement. Humans love animals. We drop big bucks on those we keep as pets. We eat animals. We make them work for us. We protect them and hunt them. We step on some of them without thinking twice while considering granting basic human rights to others. So on today's show, we're going to explore the many layers and facets of this relationship. Let's start with love. Not just any love, but fierce love. His name is Spartacus. It's undoubtedly an ironic choice because he's a skinny little thing with short white fur and a ton of energy. He's part Chihuahua, part Terrier, but he's not a barker. Spartacus is a bit of a celebrity in his South Philadelphia neighborhood, so when he goes out for a walk, he's gonna look sharp.
All right, mister, we're gonna put your sweater on. This is the newest thing. I bought it 2 days ago.
Gita Kurtz has picked a light blue sweater out of an entire drawer filled with dog clothes. This one has an argyle pattern. Think Ivy League ski club outing. Next, she fixes the hair on his head.
And not to forget the mohawk that's made you famous.
Yep, Spartacus has a tiny mohawk.
He's had, an orange dye, a green dye, a blue dye, and then we decided to go with purple this year.
And does he like that?
He does, because everybody says, oh, he's so cute, so he just poses and gets all excited.
Gita Kurtz and Spartacus make for a fetching couple. She's wearing a miniskirt, polka dot tights, and boots. Her black hair is braided in pigtails. Neighbors wave and make small talk as we walk to an upscale pet store called Doggy Style. This is where Kurtz works, but today she's just there to buy Spartacus a new sweater.
Don't yell at me for it.
She's talking to one of the clerks.
I know,
he has made a deal with her husband,
one,
Kyle, to alert him when she's buying more stuff.
No, the other one. No, Kyle doesn't know.
Kurt says she knows Spartacus is spoiled and that she's spending way too much money on him. He has 4 beds, he eats top-of-the-line expensive raw food with duck and venison, but she feels it's only right because they have a special bond, one that started the second she saw him at a shelter.
And as I walked in, there was this ugly-looking thing, not even a pound. And I'm like, that's my son. So, we're very happy.
Your son, I ask? I mean, he's a dog, right?
We know he's a dog, but he's the best dog. He's our kid.
Kurtz analyzes the dog's reactions to every purchase, how he likes or dislikes a certain sweater or a new bed. When she forgets to thaw out his special raw food, she knows Spartacus is disappointed.
He gives me this look.
What's the look?
He's like, really, Mom? Really?
He calls you Mom.
Yeah, I could see it. You know, he just blinks at me. I'm like, okay, he's giving me the really Mom look.
I should probably admit here that this notion is completely foreign to me. I don't have pets. I like animals just fine, but I don't see them as being like me. So this is all very intriguing to me. I go on to meet Jennifer Augustine and her 2 pugs.
Max is 14 and Frankie is 11. I'd hate to say this, but Max is pretty much my soulmate dog.
She says with Max, it was love at first sight.
He's amazing. He's cocky, which I love. He's independent like me, which I love. It's a connection. He is like the dog version of me.
She loves Max so much, she has his pug face tattooed on her forearm. And sometimes she's worried that Frankie, the other pug, feels slighted.
Frankie and my husband are more connected. They have more of the bond that Max and I have. Because Chris, my husband, and Frankie are very similar people.
Do you think of them as people?
Oh, goodness. I believe I do. I do. It's funny because, yeah, if someone says, "Do you have any children?" and I'll say my pugs, Max and Frankie.
It's very easy for us to perceive minds in others. So when things look like us and when things make noise, when we interact with them, when they squeal or purr or bark, right, all those cues, I mean, animals don't have language, but they have something close, and those cues compel us to see minds in creatures.
This is Kurt Gray. He is a psychology and neuroscience professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and he studies why people anthropomorphize, meaning perceive a human-like mind in a non-human agent. And he says, yes, of course, pets have minds, and they experience basic emotions like joy or fear, but not the kinds of complicated feelings we often give them credit for.
Those of us who have pets as children, I think we vastly overestimate the amount of mind they have. So people think that their dog has this like rich emotional life and can feel embarrassment and Schadenfreude and nostalgia. And I'm not sure their neural architecture supports that.
Gray has two cats. One is named Chaz, and Chaz has an evil streak at times. I know this because he told me that he and his wife spent a lot of time discussing their cats' personalities. And do you ever check yourself, given your line of work, do you ever, you know, when you go down that path of what is the cat thinking right now, do you ever just think, okay, stop, the cat is not thinking about that?
Yeah, I think my wife is also a neuroscientist, and we have conversations where we stop ourselves and say, let's really consider the neural architecture of our cats. I think we're giving them too much credit. But then at the end of the day, right, we sing them songs and we snuggle them, so maybe actions speak louder than words.
What do you sing to your cats?
Well, I think maybe my wife doesn't want me letting this out, but we often dance at them during the intro music to TV shows. So the show The Americans has this amazing kind of Russian Cossack music, and so we do like Cossack dances towards Chaz as he's sitting on the couch. He's pretty stoic, so it's all right, but I feel like a fool when I do it, but it's still fun.
So the cats don't truly appreciate your efforts.
Well, they don't not appreciate it. And I think the beautiful thing about perceiving minds is there's enough ambiguity that we can just pretend that Chaz likes us dancing at him.
So two neuroscientists doing a Russian dance at their cats while being aware of the irony of the situation, somewhat. So it seems like we just can't help ourselves. When we spend a lot of time with a pet, are we going to perceive a mind just like ours? New brain science points in that direction, says Nicholas Epley. He studies behavioral science at the University of Chicago.
The same neural systems that are involved in thinking about whether somebody else is lying or telling the truth are also the same kinds of neural systems that are involved in thinking about whether your pet has a guilty look or not.
Epley says we often have viewed anthropomorphism as a human weakness.
But to the extent that that process is the same thing that allows me to recognize that my wife of 20 years loves me, it really suggests a very different kind of understanding of this, that this, I think, reflects a signature strength of our brains. The most amazing thing your brain is able to do is to connect to the mind of another agent, to understand other people. And I think this is a natural outcropping of that.
And just like with the rest of our emotions, love or dislike for fellow humans, anthropomorphism is selective. Which creatures we anthropomorphize depends on different factors. Here's Kurt Gray again.
Cuteness factors into a lot of our decisions about animal morality. So crows, for instance, are very smart. They can understand physics problems that some children can't figure out.
But crows are not that cute. They are not cuddly, and they destroy our crops. So we don't buy them sweaters. We make scarecrows. Where and how we grow up also plays a role, says Gray.
If you work on a farm and you see animals as there to do labor, so cats are there to eat mice and dogs are there to protect your property, then you have a very different perception of animal morality than if you just live in Manhattan and you have a little frou-frou dog and she's your constant companion and you put her in a bag and you take her to Louis Vuitton, etc. So I think it's in some sense giving animals mind is a privilege that we have in our society when, you know, we're wealthy and we can just enjoy them instead of making them work.
Americans spent more than $60 billion on their pets in 2015. And the more we love them and perceive them as human-like, the more money we're going to drop on them. If you look at pet food commercials, there's a conscious effort to highlight things like love, loyalty, special relationships, unbreakable bonds.
Rocky had no idea why Don was gone for so long, but he'd wait for her forever, for any reason, and would always be there with the biggest welcome home.
Right now, research on anthropomorphism is growing, and it goes beyond our pets. Anthropomorphizing means attributing a human mind to a non-human agent, and that can be anything, a cat, a dog, or a tree, a bicycle. And with artificial intelligence gaining momentum, there is a lot of interest in the interactions between people and computers. Nicholas Epley recently ventured into new territories for anthropomorphism.
How do you get somebody to turn their life over to a stupid car?
By stupid car, he means a super high-tech self-driving vehicle. Epley just finished up a research project for General Motors. He studied what would get people over their fears with these cars. And it turns out that people are more trusting when they perceive the car to have a mind.
So when we gave an autonomous vehicle, a car, a voice, it talked to you. It responded to your actions. It told you what was coming ahead and what was happening around it. So it seemed better able to sense what was going on. People felt more comfortable driving in the simulator, and they were more likely to trust the vehicle to drive them safely.
Humans long for connection. It's what makes us human. Only when we feel a connection can we develop trust or begin a relationship. And given that the only frame of reference we have is our human mind, it's no wonder that that's what we perceive in animals we spend a lot of time with. And there's something else. So many people I talk to mentioned the unconditional, non-judgmental nature of their pet relationships. Gita Coates told me that she knows Spartacus isn't thinking what she thinks he's thinking, but it's so nice to imagine. So when she buys him a sweater and she thinks that he likes it, there's no negative feedback. It makes her happy to think that he's happy. This is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about our relationships with animals, with non-human animals. Jennifer Augustine, who we just heard from, spent over $13,000 on her pug's medical bills over the last 6 years, and he's facing ongoing health issues. He's 11 years old. A lot of people struggle when their pets are getting older and their health is declining. What treatments are appropriate? How much money can and should they spend? And when is it time to say goodbye? There's a new movement in veterinary medicine that could help answer some of these questions. It's something that's become much more important in human medicine, too, hospice and palliative care. Todd Bookman reports.
Paul Rosin has seen lots of dogs come and go during his 79 years. Suki, you get the sense, wouldn't make his Hall of Fame.
You know, we have our particular language. She knows treat. She's not, I would say, a less than, among the dogs I've had, I would say she's less than average in intelligence.
Ah, but what she lacks in brains, the white terrier with shaggy hair more than makes up for in loyalty.
Yeah, so she's been a good companion, and she's surprisingly young, though. I mean, if you look at her, you wouldn't think she was 15 years old. She's pretty active.
Suki is starting to show her 15 years in other ways, though. Her back legs are arthritic, there's a heart murmur, and she started leaving unwanted puddles around the house. That's in part prompted a call to the family's vet, Dr. Tam Mangine, who makes house calls.
Well, we'll go ahead and do her checkup. Okay. And I always look in their ears just for any signs of inflammation.
Mangine is one of a fast-growing number of vets who specialize in geriatric and end-of-life care. She avoids aggressive treatments, focusing instead on reducing pain or anxiety for dying pets. And when the time comes, she'll perform in-home euthanasia. Suki's not there yet.
So she has a whole sort of list of chronic medical conditions, no terminal diagnoses, and that's what we consider palliative care as opposed to hospice care. So in her case, we are managing the chronic conditions as they come up, making sure her quality of life is good, trying to keep her from driving her owners insane with urinating in the house and that sort of thing. But, you know, we're not managing any terminal condition for her.
This holistic approach to dying well, to making sure an animal is comfortable and that its owners feel part of the process, takes its cues from the philosophy at the heart of human hospice. Though, of course, there's one big difference.
Veterinarians and pet owners both are a little quick to go to the needle.
Jessica Pierce is with the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care, a group of veterinarians who are working to bridge the gap between expensive treatment options that a family may not be able to afford and a premature end.
Hospice tries to fill in the realm of possibilities between those two extremes.
But along with extending the animal's life in a pain-free way, pet hospice is also about the owners. It gives them the chance to have the last days or moments take place at home rather than in a clinic. Dr. Danny McVitie is co-founder of Lap of Love, a national franchise of hospice providers.
There is a huge potential to have that pet be as comfortable as possible for as long as possible, and then for the family to grieve in a way that allows them the privacy of displaying their grief and having their grief without having to hide that from anybody.
Lap of Love launched in 2009 and now operates a network of 80 doctors around the country who did more than 15,000 home visits last year. Their clients do pay a premium. In-home euthanasia runs about $250. That's more than most clinics charge. Suki's visit with her vet, Tam Mangine, is just a $70 checkup. They're going to monitor her heart murmur and bladder problems for now and get her started on a joint supplement.
Those extra 6 months can mean a lot to people. It can allow them time to adjust to the loss. And for the pets, if we can keep them comfortable, even if their day-to-day routine is different, maybe they're sniffing the smells on the porch and watching the birds instead of chasing them through the woods, they're still happy. So why not let them have that joy?
Paul Rosin is on board with that attitude.
I give her more treats than I used to. She likes the dried chicken, which you can get very cheap at Costco. And, you know, I used to say, oh, I'll give her one or two a day. You know, I'm a spoiler, but now I give her a lot because what the hell? That's one of the things she really loves.
Well, you only live once, right? For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, we're going to step into the operating room for a complicated surgery, creating eyelids from tissue in the patient's mouth.
It's a mucous membrane. Gingiva, which is the inner lining, you know, when you bite your cheek, that's very similar to conjunctiva, which is the lining of the eyelids. So the tissues themselves are quite similar.
And in this case, the patient is a stray cat. That's next on The Pulse. We're talking today about our relationship with animals. How far would you go to save a stray cat? Actually, not even to save the cat, but to save the cat's eyesight. Reporter Peter Crimmins brings us the extraordinary journey of Marley.
In the summer of 2015, two tiny white kittens were pulled off the streets in the Overbrook neighborhood of Philadelphia by the city's animal control team. They were Marley and Ramona, brother and sister. After 3 days in a city shelter, they were turned over to PAWS, the Philadelphia Animal Welfare Society.
So they actually came to us on July 4th. They were Independence Day kittens for us.
This is Melissa Levy. She's the founding director of PAWS.
And had a number of infections that are very common that we see all the time in kittens and cats that have lived on the street or have been in a shelter. They had upper respiratory infections and, you know, they were in pretty bad shape.
Pretty bad, but simple infections are really not that difficult to fix. These cats had bigger problems with their eyes. One of Ramona's eyes was so infected it was bulging out of her skull, and Marley had been born without eyelids. He had no eyelids. He could not close his eyes, not to blink, not to sleep, not to protect his eyes from dust.
The condition that Marley had is actually very unusual for us. Typically what we see are infections that are pretty easily resolved with medication. What Marley had was a genetic deformity that required essentially plastic surgery.
Levy has a Rolodex of a few dozen fosters that will take on cats until permanent owners can be found. But she reserves her special cases like these for one guy in particular, Al Guri.
I'm a professor at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia.
For almost 40 years now, Guri has lived and worked in an artist loft in Old City. He has outfitted it for both his painting career and his life with cats. He has five cats of his own, and next to his easel is a homemade playpen built from plywood scraps in which he keeps sick kittens that he's fostering. And there have been a lot. Over the last 10 years, Guri has fostered over 800 cats in this loft. 800. He keeps them for a few weeks, maybe a few months, until they can be adopted out. He took on Marley and his sister last July.
They were very little. They were only 4 weeks old. So they needed a lot of nurturing at that point, as well as medical care. I had to give them a lot of cuddling, a lot of holding, make sure that they were getting socialized with a human being, but then also the medical care, which of course they hated. You know, they don't like drops. Who likes eye drops?
Guri found out pretty quickly that Ramona's infection in her right eye was too far gone. The whole eye would have to be removed. Marley has a genetic deformation called eyelid agenesis. That's when the eyelid did not fully form in utero.
I've seen him sleep and he just squinches his eyes. The problem is that his eyelashes and the surrounding hair is lying flat on the cornea.
That means the fur around Marley's eye is constantly scratching his eyeball, slowly destroying its surface.
Also, there's an issue of lubrication and constant abrasion, he would develop abscesses.
The easiest way to cure Marley's eye condition, and quite frankly the cheapest, would be just to remove both his eyes altogether.
You know, if there was no other recourse, sure, like Ramona had to have an eye removed. But these were two perfect eyes, and I think being an artist and an art teacher, it had special meaning for me, you know, how important they are.
Guri wanted the best for Marley, but animal rescue has its limitations. Every year, PAWS rescues, nurtures, and adopts out over 3,000 dogs and cats in the Philadelphia area. Most of them are cats.
Unfortunately, our resources prevented us from being in a position to be able to write a blank check.
This is Melissa Levy again.
Once we assessed what our, you know, financial risk constraints were, that was when Al took it into his own hands.
Guri got in touch with a specialty hospital called VSEC, or Veterinary Specialty and Emergency Center. They formed a plan to give plastic surgery to this stray cat. Enter Dr. Shelby Reinstein. She's a veterinary ophthalmologist.
This particular surgery is not rare. The condition itself is super common, especially here in Philadelphia, where we have a lot of strays and a lot of street cats. You know, things don't form right when there's a lot of inbreeding.
So 7 months after being pulled off the street, Marley went under the knife.
So we're going to cut here, right, and we're going to come down all the way to about here.
What Reinstein is doing is grafting a piece of Marley's inner lip onto his eyebrow so the lip tissue will become his eyelid tissue.
It's a mucous membrane. Gingiva, which is the inner lining, you know, when you bite your cheek, that's very similar to conjunctiva, which is the lining of the eyelids. So the tissues themselves are quite similar. One makes tears, one makes spit.
Eyelid agenesis surgery is expensive, particularly for a cat that doesn't have an owner. The hospital gave Marley a deal with a price cut, and Guri tapped all his friends for a few hundred dollars. But that still leaves a $3,000 medical bill, which Guri will pay out of his own pocket. After surgery, Guri took Marley home, where his sister Ramona was waiting for him. After about a month of recovery, Guri will give the two cats back to PAWS so they can be adopted.
You know, I love them. He's a sweet little guy. He prances around the house like a pony. His sister likes to sit on my shoulder and groom my hair, so that will be missed.
Guri cared for Marley and Ramona for 9 months. That's an extraordinary amount of time for a foster, plus $3,000, and he's probably never going to see them again. Melissa Levy hopes they will be taken together.
The level of generosity and the level of charity toward this particular kitten was so far beyond what we would have been able to do on our own. It's just, it's an incredibly moving thing to watch unfold.
For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
¶¶
listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to move on now from saving stray kittens to saving species living in their ecosystems. When the balance between predators and prey has somewhat gotten out of whack, scientists have to weigh their options. Should they intervene, or will that intervention cause more trouble? And what happens when they make the wrong decision? A 2007 study blamed declines in oyster and other shellfish stocks in the Chesapeake Bay on a specific type of stingray. Soon, a campaign was underway to combat what seemed like a new enemy. Save the bay, eat a ray. I recently spoke to ecologist Dean Grubbs of Florida State University. He has just published a rebuttal to this study. He says it's the ray that needs saving. The species is called the cow-nose ray, and I asked him to describe this fish.
So the cow-nose ray is a very common, relatively large stingray that lives up and down the east coast of the U.S. and in the Gulf of Mexico. It gets to be about 3 feet across, something like that, about 50 pounds, maybe a little more than that. And they travel in enormous schools. Schools of tens to hundreds of thousands will migrate up and down the east coast of the U.S. They're kind of shaped like a trapezoid, sharp-pointed pectoral fins, and they have this sort of indented, flattened snout that's sort of reminiscent of a cow's snout, and hence that's the reason why it's called the cow-nose ray. It's not a very good name, though, because it's actually a really beautiful, elegant fish.
And what did the 2007 study conclude about the cow-nose ray?
Well, the crux of the 2007 study was that there was drastic declines in large coastal shark populations up and down the East Coast. And as a result, their purported prey, the cow-nose ray population, had then exploded. And this exploding cow-nose ray population had then allowed them to basically run amok, feeding on oysters and bay scallops and other commercial bivalve that people like to eat. The big problem with that study is that we had spent, a number of us have spent many years, decades in fact, studying the populations of the large coastal sharks. And we knew from the stock assessments and from many data sets that the declines in large coastal sharks were not that severe. And in fact, many stocks had been recovering for a number of years due to very aggressive fisheries management. And then in addition to that, we knew that it's biologically impossible for cow-nose ray populations to explode, as was purported, because since a cow-nose ray only produces one pup every year, you can imagine that the population doubling time is many decades. So the idea that they could increase exponentially over a 10-year period just didn't make sense.
So were people fishing more for these rays as a result of the study?
This study and all the publicity it got actually got the public behind the idea of developing a fishery for cow-nose rays. And so there were efforts to develop a market in South Korea to sell cow-nose rays from the U.S. and South Korea. There were efforts to develop leather markets for them, things like that. Through the Save the Bay, Eat a Ray campaign, there were even restaurants that pride themselves on only selling, cultured oysters with cow-nose rays as sort of a Save the Bay, appetizer.
Were you freaking out during this period? Did you feel this is all wrong?
Well, we knew from the beginning, we knew that the shark populations had not declined nearly as severely as they thought. We were concerned, very concerned, that the development of this fishery, in addition to the commercial fishery, though, there was the development of bow fishing tournaments where participants would basically go out with hunting bows, compound bows, and just hunt cow-nose rays. And so our main concern and what drove us to published the rebuttal to the 2007 paper was to encourage managers to actually develop management plans for cow-nose rays if they're going to develop a fishery.
What are the main points that you made in your rebuttal?
We showed that the original authors had picked a single data set to show the most severe declines in the large sharks that were possible. We also show that the Kaunas ray has one of the most vulnerable life histories of any shark or ray species known. And so extreme caution should be exerted if you're going to start a fishery for them. We looked at the landings data for oysters and the scallops, bay scallops, and we showed that basically those stocks and those fisheries had collapsed 1 to 2 decades at least prior to the supposed increase in the Kaunas ray. So the Kaunas rays clearly are not the cause of the collapse of those shellfish stocks. Rather, it was overfishing, disease, pollution, and things like that. But the Kaunas rays essentially made a convenient scapegoat for our own misdeeds.
Dean, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dean Grubbs is an ecologist with Florida State University, and he hopes that this rebuttal will encourage fisheries to protect the population of Kaunas rays. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A Southern California community recently experienced the biggest natural gas leak in U.S. history.
A slow-motion environmental disaster in California where a torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air.
Thousands have been relocated. A state of emergency in response to
this infrared video shows gas rolling off the top of a nearby ridge down into the community of Porter Ranch.
There was a second leak, but that one was fixed much more quickly. But there is a lot of concern over ongoing environmental consequences from this disaster. Now, get this. There's a much bigger source of methane pollution, but this one gives us our milkshakes and burgers. Each year, cows in the U.S. burp out 65 times more gas than was released in the now infamous California leak. Jessica McDonald reports on a discovery that could cut down those emissions.
I'm standing in Penn State University's Dairy Cow Research Barn. It's a bit smaller than a football field, single-story, full of fluorescent lighting and the scent of fresh manure. In front of me, corralled in two long rows of stalls, are 60 black and white Holstein dairy cows, the classic kind featured on milk jugs. They're huge, 1,400 pounds each, with plastic yellow ID tags on their ears. Standing next to me is animal science professor Alex Pristov. He's Bulgarian with graying hair, and he looks proudly at his herd.
They milk about 100 pounds of milk a day. They eat a lot, so they're good cows.
All that eating, though, comes with a cost.
They burp gas all the time. They produce gas all the time, 24 hours.
Sadly for me and my microphone, the belching is silent. Christoph is particularly concerned about methane. Methane doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but over a century, it traps heat 25 times better. About a quarter of the world's methane pollution comes from livestock, which is why Christoph and his team have gotten very good at quantifying the amount their cows exhale. Prompted by some extra snacks, cow number 2050 ducks her head into a hooded machine that can analyze her burps.
And there is a slight vacuum through the system, so all the gases are captured going through the sensors.
During experiments, the scientists take 8 of these measurements from each cow over several days. In a few months, this gives a snapshot of just how much methane the animals churn out, and whether particular interventions work to cut those emissions. After a short drive back to the university's animal science lab building, Christoph says the reason cows are such big producers of methane is part of what makes them so special. They can eat things humans, or even other farm animals, including pigs, can't, like grass and hay.
And it's all because of a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria in their rumen.
The rumen is the first section of the cow's famous 4-compartment stomach. It's where the food is first broken down into a slush by trillions of hardworking bacteria. Their job? To ferment the feed so that it can be turned into flesh or milk. In this fermentation process, a lot of hydrogen gas is made. If too much builds up, it can stop digestion. Luckily, there are bugs called methanogens that can take care of it.
And they have specialized into taking that hydrogen, taking the carbon dioxide, and putting it together and making methane that the animal burps out.
Scientists call it eructation. Contrary to popular belief, very little methane actually comes out the other end.
Cows really don't release anything from their backside.
One way to reduce the environmental impact of digestion is to try to chemically block the creation of methane. Christoph's group has been testing an inhibitor to do just that. It's called 3-nitrooxypropanol, or 3-NOP, and prevents an enzyme in bacteria from powering the last step of methane formation. So far, the compound appears to work. In the team's study, methane emissions fell by 30%, a decrease that persisted for the entire 12-week period the cows were on the drug. Ristov calls it a breakthrough.
I've been looking at methane for probably 15 years now, and this is the most exciting results that we have so far.
It's potentially great news for the environment, but it won't mean much if it's not used. And right now, farmers have no incentive to buy it.
Just reducing methane is not going to sell this.
Historically, methane inhibitors have been of interest to the beef industry, not as a way to cut greenhouse emissions, but to save money. Andy Cole, a retired USDA scientist in Texas, studied the drugs back in the mid-70s.
Now, at the time, that was before the term greenhouse gas or global warming had ever even been used.
The idea was just to find a more efficient, cheaper way to raise cattle. Up to 10% of a cow's food is wasted on making methane.
That's energy that possibly could have ended up in the muscle or in the milk.
In theory, by blocking methane formation, the animals can put those calories to better use, bulking up faster, pumping out more milk, making ranchers more money. But Cole never found an inhibitor that worked well. Many were toxic. 40 years later, Christoph thinks he's onto something.
All the data we have are extremely positive.
It's still too early to say the inhibitor will be a success. Lots of tests are needed to make sure the compound is safe for cows, and of course, the humans who drink the milk. But if Histrov's right, the drug just might help farmers' pocketbooks as well as the planet. For The Pulse, I'm Jessica McDonald.
Coming up, we're going to dig through a very special record collection featuring bird sounds. And if you're trying to identify the birds chirping here, you've got the wrong species. Think Homo sapiens, not aves. Still to come on The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about the many complicated interactions between humans and animals. Our next story is about one of the side effects of humans eating animals. Most commercial fishing is not an exact operation. Big nets catch a lot of species unintentionally. This is typically referred to as bycatch. It affects dolphins, birds, juvenile fish, and sea turtles, many of which are already endangered. When sea turtles get stuck in a net, they drown. A team of scientists is now trying to prevent this problem with sound. Paige Flager reports.
Imagine a sea turtle. It's swimming around in the ocean, going about its everyday business, and then all of a sudden, it hears a sound. Something like this. The sea turtle's ears, yes, they have ears, perk up. That noise is not something it usually hears in the ocean. Now it's on high alert, looking out for something abnormal in the water, like a fisherman's net. That's the idea behind Wendy Dow-Piniak's work at Gettysburg College. She's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies Department, and she specializes in sea turtles and sound.
The goal of our team's research is to develop bycatch reduction technologies or tools that can reduce sea turtle bycatch but also maintain target fish catch and market values that can also be implemented in a variety of different types of fisheries.
In non-science speak, the idea is for fishermen to catch what they want to catch without catching sea turtles accidentally.
In essence, what we want to do is to design some kind of alerting signal that tells the sea turtle that something's out of the ordinary. So, pay attention. But we also want it to be a cue that the target catch or fish that the fishers are trying to catch aren't alerted by.
But that's kind of hard, right? Like, basically they need something that only sea turtles can hear, not other fish. Kind of like how a dog can hear super high-pitched sounds, but humans can't.
But people hadn't really considered acoustic deterrent devices for sea turtles because most sea turtles and fish hear very similar frequencies.
The fishery that she and her team are working in is in Baja, Mexico. And the fish that that fishery is trying to get is halibut. Now, halibut is a flat fish because it hangs out on the bottom of the ocean. It doesn't have a swim bladder, which is an air-filled sac that keeps most fish buoyant. And, luckily for Piniak, they have really bad hearing.
So flatfish hear generally below 200 hertz, which are very, very low frequencies.
It sounds like this.
And sea turtles can hear up to about 1600 hertz.
Which sounds like this. So as long as they attach a sound to the net with a frequency between that low sound and that high sound, theoretically, only the turtles could hear it and be warned, and the halibut would swim into the net just like normal. They went with frequencies around 300 hertz.
We wanted to pick a signal that we knew the sea turtles would be able to detect quite easily.
Piniac and her team made a device using a recorder that played the sound, an amplifier that made it louder, and then a speaker further down on the net to play the noise out into the ocean. It's called an acoustic deterrent device. Of course, there's already sound in the ocean. Researchers call this an acoustic habitat or soundscape. It's a really important sensory cue for marine animals.
Animals in the ocean often use acoustic cues to communicate with each other, to find food and to navigate, or for just general environmental awareness.
At their study site in Baja, the ocean usually sounds like this.
The crackle and popping that you hear in the background are small crustaceans called snapping shrimp. They make that sound by snapping shut their claws and use it to stun their prey. You can actually hear the sounds of waves crashing on the shore and the boat rocking and also a little bit of wind noise.
So that's where the experiment comes in. They put two nets into the water. The first doesn't make any sound. The second, the one with the acoustic deterrent devices, sounds like this. The nets are close enough together that they're in the same environment and could catch the same things, but they're far enough apart that any marine life near the control net wouldn't be able to hear any of the sounds from the deterrent devices on the other net.
Over the last two summers, we found that adding the acoustic devices to nets reduces the number of sea turtles you catch by 65%, which is huge.
It's huge, Piniac says, but there's still a lot of work to be done. The team wants to test the devices in other fisheries that target flatfish, like flounder and turbot. They want to study not just the decreased catch of turtles, but also how the devices might affect the fish that fishermen actually want to catch. The end goal, she says, is to create a product that fishermen really want to use. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been talking about our relationships with animals today. My childhood pet was a bird, a yellow parakeet named Goldie. Having a bird didn't exactly score big with my friends, and I'm pretty sure my mom picked this pet because of the minimal cleanup involved. But for centuries, birds had a very special place in our homes. Before stereos, before radios, nightingales and canaries were trained to sing to entertain us. I guess you could say they were the medieval public radio. But when music producer and researcher Ian Nagoski went digging through old records a few years back, he discovered an interesting turn in this entertainment relationship, man imitating birds.
Pretty much all of my research begins with just the process of going through old 78 RPM discs and seeing what's lying around that nobody has bothered with. I noticed that there were lots of recordings of birds themselves accompanied by musical instruments. It was a pretty big thing. There were hundreds of such recordings made. This is one of those many recordings of some kind of canary aviary accompanied by some sentimental piano music. I can't remember the performer's name, and frankly, who cares? I think it's sentimental schlock. People wanted something pretty to listen to around the house, and in the early days of the record industry, from the last decade of the 19th century through the first two decades of the 20th century, the record companies were really casting around in the dark for anything they thought people might want to listen to at home. At a certain point, I noticed that there were recordings of people imitating animals. In particular, there was a genre of people whistling in imitation of birds.
A good example is that of the catbird.
And so I put the needle on and go, what in the world is this? It would have been recorded in the mid-teens, I guess, about 100 years ago. At first, I would say I was just, delighted by what an interesting, odd skill it was, how exotic it was to our present time. I'd never seen anybody do such a thing.
Here is Alec Walker, the Birdman, to teach you how.
No, listen, it's hard. I think it's undeniable that a real virtuoso can't pretty well fool you that they're not being a bird, They sound like birds to me. They sound better than birds, actually, which is odd.
Blue Jay.
These bird imitators were live performers. They were stage people who were traveling around playing in church halls and, by and large, vaudeville. They were people who were amazing and amusing their audiences. The best of them, by far, is Charles Kellogg. He was a great performer, and he got very, very rich. Kellogg claimed that he had a bird syrinx, an entirely different vocal apparatus than other human beings, which was not true, to say the least. There's a less polite way to put that, but that was showbiz.
American Robin.
So I've given it some thought, and I think the reason that bird imitation doesn't exist so much anymore as an entertainment thing is because in order for it to be really amazing and wonderful, it's got to be in person. To have it through some media is actually less wonderful and less amazing than to see a human being with the sound of a bird coming out of them.
Plump little California quail.
People have been looking to birds and wondering what it is they're trying to say for hundreds, thousands of years. Reveling in the wonder of bird song and how musical, how obviously beautiful it is, and how incredibly foreign it is to us, too. In the opera cycle by Richard Wagner, The Ring of the Nibelungen, the character Siegfried slays a dragon and eats its heart, and he gets magical powers. And what magical power is it? It's to understand the language of birds.
And then by opening and closing them, you get the varying volume of sound.
How wonderful that would be. What a perfect magic power to have. How amazing would that be, to know what it is that they're saying and singing.
Like this. Now you have the four sounds that make up the laugh of the kookaburra. And when you can make them satisfactorily, join them all together. Now you should be able to imitate Jackie quite easily.
That was music collector and researcher Ian Nagoski. Alana Gordon produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and we had engineering help this week from Adam Staniszewski. Paige Flager is our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, after 40 years in prison, everything on the outside is new.
Everything. I can't really put my finger on one simple thing.
Traffic, people, movement, being out after dark, seeing the stars.
Also new, taking care of your health yourself.
This is the first time I ever paid a copay today.
Don't miss the next episode of The Pulse. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And I move these fly away like a hummingbird in a
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.